I'm happy to be with you tonight. Very grateful to Suze and Tracy for managing this evening, and all the volunteers from the Death and Dying Group. There's a beautiful Japanese term, shoji, and it usually translates as birth death, one word, birth death, or sometimes life death. No separation between life and death, just a thin, small line connecting the two. I don't think we can be really, truly alive without maintaining some awareness of death. Death's not waiting for us at the end of a long road. Death is always with us in the marrow of every passing moment. She is the secret teacher hiding in plain sight, the one that helps us to discover what matters most. And the really good news is that we don't have to wait until the time of our dying to learn the lessons that she has to teach. I mean, to imagine that at the time of your death, you will have the physical strength, the emotional stability, the mental clarity to do the work of a lifetime is a ridiculous gamble. Time for the conversation is now. You know, in the past few decades, it seems to me that we've distanced ourselves from death. You know, we've made care of the dying unnecessarily complex. And when we took this incredibly intimate act of looking after one another and we turned it into a task or a duty or an obligation, how did we do that? How'd that happen? Yeah. Dying's not predominantly a medical event. We need to bring the best of what medicine has to offer to the care of the dying, but I'm not sure we should allow it to drive the bus. I think that what happens in the dying process, the process itself, is so profound that it doesn't fit neatly into any model, including most spiritual models. Suppose instead of compartmentalizing death and cutting it off from life, we were to imagine or regard dying as a final stage of our lives, final stage of growth, yeah? I mean, might we then, instead of telling ourselves scary stories about dying, suppose we told ourselves really positive stories about dying? Not just made up positive stories, but we shared our positive stories. A lot of us have them. And then I wonder, could we then turn toward death and say, how then shall we live? Yeah? I always have this feeling that we have beautiful galleries in which great paintings hang. And we go to them and get refreshed by them, you know? I always have the feeling that we should have beautiful homes in every community where people come to die. And we go to them and visit with them and say, help me understand about living. Yeah? I think the encounter with death can introduce us and perhaps even help us develop the deepest dimensions of our being. Really. So oftentimes we think about it or deal with it as if we're just making the best of a bad situation. That's usually how we deal with dying. We're making the best of a bad situation. And when we do that, I think we devalue dying and I think we rob it of its holy significance. So we have gatherings like tonight, which are beautiful, where we all come together and visit about it, you know, and explore together. That's why there are all these great things happening, like death cafes. And, you know, Michael Heeb started Death Over Dinner here in Seattle. What a great project. Do you know about that project? Oh, it's fantastic. It's right here in your hometown. Michael's a sometimes professor at the university and he's a friend of my son's, and he created a program called Death Over Dinner, which I think is a great title, by the way. And you go to the website, check it out, and there's all these templates about how to have a conversation over dinner about death. And people get together and they have people to their homes or to a restaurant or some such place. And there's all these different templates about how to deal with this, how to talk about the spiritual dimensions, how to talk about durable powers of attorney, how to talk about the medical interventions, all of it. It's just great. There's a whole bunch of different templates about how to have the conversation. So check it out. I think without a reminder of death, we tend to take life for granted. Yeah. We get caught up in endless pursuits of self-gratification. And but when we recognize, you know, how precarious this life actually is, then we come to appreciate how precious it is, and then we don't want to waste a minute, you know. When we get it that everything's coming and going all the time, I think we don't hold on so tightly. I think we don't take ourselves and our ideas so seriously. And I think it engenders a certain kindness when we realize that death comes to everyone, that we're all in the boat together. Look, I'm not romantic about dying. It's the hardest work you'll ever do. It's tough. And it's incredibly painful sometimes, and messy, and tragic, and beautiful, and transformative. But most of all, it's normal. It's ordinary. We all go through it. Nobody gets out alive. I mean, maybe tonight, but I don't even guarantee that. Yeah. Yeah. So, as Tracy mentioned in her very kind introduction, I started a program called the Zen Hospice Project. We started it in San Francisco. And we didn't have much of a plan. We just thought there was a natural match between people cultivating what we might call the listening mind or the listening heart through meditation practice and people who needed to be heard at least once in their life, folks who were dying. And we started by working with people who lived, you know, in difficult conditions, you know, rat-infested hotels and on park benches behind City Hall. I changed a lot of diapers on park benches behind City Hall. They were alcoholics and prostitutes and homeless folks, people who lived on the margins of society. And they didn't trust very easily. And if we were going to be of any use to them, we had to be real. We couldn't give them any of our Buddhist rhetoric, you know. Some of the people I worked with, they came from cultures that I didn't know, speaking languages that I couldn't understand. Some of them had great faith that really carried them through their dying process, and some of them had sworn off religion years ago. There was a wonderful man, Nguyen, I remember. He was a Vietnamese man, and he was really scared of ghosts. And his roommate was Isaiah, an African-American man who was very comforted by nightly visits from his dead mother. Yeah. We cared for young folks, 20 years old, dying of AIDS. And then there was Elizabeth, who at 93 said to me, "Why has death come for me so soon?" There was this man I worked with, he was a hemophiliac and he had contracted the HIV virus through a blood transfusion. But the year before, he had disowned his gay son when his son had announced to him that he was HIV positive. And now father and son were in the same room, in twin beds, being cared for by Agnes, the son's mother, and the father's wife. Some of the people that I work with, they blossomed. And they found a kindness and love they've been looking for their whole lives. And other people, they turned toward the wall and withdrawal and hopelessness and they never came back again. And all of them were my teachers. Yeah. Dying is inevitable and intimate. You can't do the work of accompanying the dying from a distance. What I saw regularly was that people like you and I, ordinary folks, Many people that I work with had no inner life practice, no spiritual practice, no religious traditions. They were just getting by. But I saw them meet what they imagined would be unimaginable and unbearable, really, in extraordinary ways. And frequently they discovered themselves to be a much more, they discovered an aspect of themselves, is a better way to say it, that was much more expansive than the small separate self they'd taken themselves to be. Sometimes that happened in the final days of life or weeks of life, and sometimes in the final minutes of life. Now you might say, too late. And I would tend to agree, it's too late. But here's the thing. If that transformation happens then, it doesn't matter how long it's enjoyed. What's important about it is that it exists. And if it exists at the time of dying, well then it exists now. And we don't have to wait until then. So a while back, I developed these five invitations. We called them precepts sometimes and invitations at other times. And they were really guides to help us figure out, you know, what would guide us as we were being with people and at the end of life. How would we do it? And then, and they guided us at the hospice. Well, I was there for 20 years. They guided us for 20 years. Still going on. But also we saw that they later saw that they had a relevance for all of us in living a more meaningful and happy and purposeful life. So I thought that's what I would speak about tonight and try and share those with you. It's really what the book's about. An invitation is a request for you to show up. You know, if I invite you to my house for dinner, you got to show up, right? Or if I invite you to my wedding, you have to show up. So these invitations are an invitation for you to show up for your life, yeah, in every way possible. The first invitation, the one that we speak about at the very beginning, is don't wait. Don't wait. I mean, waiting is full of expectation. Waiting for the next moment to arrive, we miss this one. I can't tell you how many times I've been with people who are dying and or their families, and they've said to me, when is mom going to die? And waiting for the moment of dying, we miss all the moments in between. You know, worrying and strategizing about what the future holds, we miss the opportunities right in front of us. There was a guy I worked with, he was on my board, and his mother was dying. The doctors called him and said that she had about 6 weeks to live. And so he said, when should I go? And you know, that's a quandary a lot of us live with. We live at a distance from our families, you know. And I said, I don't know. Come on over, we'll talk about it. So he came over and we visited and I asked him to tell me about what the doctors had said and he shared with me their prognosis, etc. And then I said, well, tell me about your mom. And he began to talk about his mom, and as he talked about her with great tenderness, I noticed the color in his cheek starting to change. And I saw that his chin was trembling just slightly. And I said, I think you should go tonight. And he said, oh, I can't go. I have business tomorrow, you know. Very successful businessman. And I said, no, I think you should go tonight. Take the red eye. So he agreed, and he did. And he flew to Toronto. And he got there at 10 o'clock in the morning. And at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, he was sitting with his mother when she died. Yeah. Don't wait. Don't wait to tell people you love that you love them. You know, mostly we imagine that death will come later. Does anybody think that will happen? Death will come later? Later gives us that comfortable distance that we like. The illusion of a safe distance. But constant change, impermanence, it's not later. It's right now. Change is the norm, right? George Harrison told us, everything must pass. Everything will pass. This moment will give rise to the next. Where's my childhood? Where's this morning's breakfast? Where's last night's lovemaking? Where, could someone please tell me, has my blonde hair gone? This is not a magic trick. It's woven into the very fabric of our existence. Impermanence is perfectly natural, normal, and our most constant companion. You know, I love to lie in bed in the mornings. I like it a lot, actually. I don't like to get up early and meditate. I like to lie in bed. I like to pull the comforters over me, particularly on winter mornings when it's cool, you know. It's just great. Everything is good in the world in that moment, yeah. And then I have to pee, yeah. I got to get up, run to the toilet, come back, jump into bed, try and recreate the same conditions that I had before. But it's not possible. I can't ever get them right again. Yeah, it doesn't work. Intellectually, we may understand that our mother's treasured vase will one day fall off the shelves, that our car will break down, that our relationships will end, you know. The challenge or the work for us is to take that understanding that lives in our intellect and nestle it into our hearts. Yeah. We rely on impermanence, don't we? I mean, you know, this cold you have, it's going to go away. Right? That really boring dinner party you go to this weekend, it's going to end. Yeah. Evil dictatorships will fall. Presidential terms will end. Yeah. If not for impermanence, you know, life couldn't be. Your children wouldn't grow up. Your daughter wouldn't become a scientist. In a few weeks, I'm going to Japan with Roshi Joan Halifax, do some things over there, and we'll be there. And at the height of cherry blossom season, and cherry blossoms cover the whole hillsides in Japan, you know. And it's just beautiful. Or I teach, we know up in Sandpoint, some friends here from Sandpoint tonight, and I teach at this little cabin. And outside the cabin there are these little blue flax flowers that last for a single day. Now can you tell me, why are those cherry blossoms, why are those blue flax flowers so much more beautiful than plastic flowers? Huh? I mean, isn't it their fragility and the brevity of their lives that introduce us to their wonder and beauty? So at its heart, what this invitation, don't wait, is asking of us, is to savor our life, to touch the texture of it, to remind us that past and future are stories, that the only place we can really live fully is here and now. And that when we live in just our ideas of things, we lose the immediacy of our experience. Carol Hyman, a great Buddhist writer, she said, when we understand, when we begin to grasp and lean into uncertainty, then we realize that our nature and the nature of the rest of the world isn't fundamentally different. And then the fact that things are not stable and fixed, this becomes a liberating opportunity rather than a threat. Yeah. It's all changing. It's all coming and going. And it's possible to hold it all with love and compassion. Okay, the second invitation is welcome everything, push away nothing. Now that sounds really good, right? Make a good bumper sticker. Welcome everything, push away nothing. How do you do that? I mean, at Zen Hospice, what we did was we created a beautiful environment in which people came to live and die. And we didn't have a whole lot of ideas about how they should do that. We basically, you know, thought it was up to them. The word welcome confronts us, actually. It asks us to temporarily suspend our usual rush to judgment. Yeah. We don't have to like what comes. And we don't have to agree with it. We just have to be willing to welcome it. It's at our doorstep. What does it have to show us? I have a friend who went to dinner at the home of a very renowned psychiatrist, bright man, graceful man, who had developed Alzheimer's. And so he didn't recognize people so well anymore. He didn't remember names hardly at all. And they rang the doorbell, and he opened the door, and he stood there looking a little confused for a minute. And then he said, "I'm so sorry, I don't remember names anymore, and I don't know your faces. But I know this is my house. And my house has always been a place where people were welcome. So if you're standing on my doorstep, I know my job is to invite you in." Yeah. My wife is British. They don't use the term welcome in England, you know. It's not a common term. So when she said to me, "What does welcome mean? Why do you use that welcoming thing?" And she said, "What is that?" And I said, "It's like this. This is welcoming." You know, when we're open and receptive, we have options. You know, we're free to discover, to investigate, to explore, to respond skillfully to anything we encounter. But if we block it, if we defend against its presence, it's got us. We can't be free if we are rejecting any part of ourselves. Great African-American writer James Baldwin, he said it beautifully. He said, you know, "Not everything that can be faced can be changed. But nothing can be changed if it's not faced." I had a heart attack a few years ago. Big deal, having a heart attack. I had triple bypass surgery. I was teaching a retreat for doctors and nurses on compassion. I completely denied it, like three times. I had pain, really bad chest pain first time, and I thought, it's indigestion. And I asked my assistant to get me some Tums. Honestly, that's why it worked. And the second time, I was leading a meditation on sensing the body. And I had all this, you know, angina, pain going through my body, and I, sensing, you know. Oh, God. Sometimes our practice is not always what we imagine. I had a big surgery, and it took a long time to recover. It took me about 6 months to recover. They cut, by mistake, they cut my phrenic nerve, which is what controls the diaphragm, and so my left lung didn't work for a long time. In fact, just sidebar here, I went back to the same retreat center where I had been teaching 6 months later to have a little personal retreat. And I started to feel this heart pain again. So I called my friend, Angie, who I teach with, she's a psychotherapist, and I said, "I think it's just my mind. Don't you think it's my mind?" And she said, "Yeah, but it could be your heart. Go to the hospital." And sure enough, I was having another heart attack. Yeah. Yeah, the grafts that they had made failed. I was talking to Jack Kornfield, and he called me up, and he said, "Franco, you got to take it easy." And I said, "Jack, I do take it easy. You know, I said, the only time I have heart attacks is at meditation retreats." At Catholic retreat centers, by the way. I was supposed to go to Italy to teach, and Jack said, "Oh, don't go." And he said, "Don't go anywhere near the Vatican, it'll kill you." So anyway, when I was recovering, this well-known Tibetan teacher, I won't say who, he called me up to support me. And I thought, oh good, you know, he's going to help me figure out what practice I should use now. And I said, "How did you deal with it? The drama, the pain, the depression, the vulnerability, all that comes with a heart condition, a heart attack." And there was this pause on the other end of the phone, and then he said, "Well, I think it's good to have a heart." And he said, "If you have a heart, you should expect it will have problems." And then he told me to rest a lot more, and then he hung up. That was it. No esoteric practice. And afterwards I thought, you know, he's right. You know, if we have a human life, we should expect that we'll have problems. Yeah. So I think at a very deep level, this particular invitation is really reminding us, or is an invitation, to cultivate a kind of fearless receptivity, actually. To welcome everything and push away nothing. You can't do that as an act of will. It only can be done as an act of love. Fearlessness, by the way, doesn't mean you have no fear. It means fear is not the only thing in the room. Yeah? So to be human, I think, is much more than getting born and getting a good education and finding the right partner and getting a pretty house on a nice street and then going to sleep and waking up in the morning, going to work and doing it all over again. I think this is an invitation to feel everything. You know, the beauty and horror of this life of ours, you know. It's an opportunity to be conscious of the fact that some of us will make love while others make war. It's to recognize the truth that there are babies like my dear granddaughter, you know, whose mother, you know, who was born into the loving arms of a mother who kisses her bright future into her every night. You know? And there are people like Carolyn, who I knew, whose mother left her in a dumpster when she was a baby. And it's to embrace the night screams from Syrian refugee camps. And the fact that there are children tonight who are making tents out of living room pillows and bed sheets. It's to know that children get shot in our schools. And others speak truth to power. Remarkable what they're doing. It's to realize that there's devastation and hopelessness and there's passion and the holy commitment to create a better future for all of us. Welcome everything. Push away nothing. The third invitation is bring your whole self to the experience. Bring your whole self to the experience. Now, we all like to look good, right? We try our best. We want to be capable and strong or intelligent or at least seen as fairly well adjusted. We like to project a positive self-image, you know. We want to be known for our, we don't want to be known for our helplessness or our fear or our anger, you know. Or that sometimes we're much more of a mess than we like to admit. Yet more than once, frequently in fact, I've found that the qualities that are most undesirable in me, the ones that I'm most ashamed of, the ones that I'm most embarrassed about, you know, they were frequently that which enabled me to build an empathetic bridge to the people I served. You know, when we take care of others, and Tracy and I were talking about this on the way over, when we take care of other people, we often think that it's our expertise that will help. And our expertise does help. It's good to have good skills. Yeah? But, you know, not just our expertise that helps. I have a whole toolbox of tools. I've developed them over years. Great big yellow toolbox, you know? But if I set that toolbox down between me and a person I'm working with, a client, one of us is sure to trip over it, you know? So I don't lead with my tools. I lead with my humanity. So to be whole, you know, we've got to accept and connect all the parts of ourselves. My daughter and I, we go shopping together sometimes, and she likes to shop in consignment stores, you know, like used clothing stores. And she'll find a really great, cool paisley scarf or cool pair of shoes or something. And she'll go in the dressing room and try it on. And I go around looking for the next really cool thing that would be right for her. And we're in this one shop, you know. And you know how it is in these shops. There's a little stain in the clothing, or a button's missing, or a little tear, or something like that, you know. So I'm looking through the rack, and I find this blouse, and it looks great, and I pick it up to give it to her, and I notice on the tag it says, $9.95 as is. $9.95 as is. I like that tag. I think we should get those tags for ourselves and each other. As is. I mean, what a beautiful way to treat ourselves and to treat each other. I take you as is. That was part of my wedding vow to my wife, by the way. I take you as is. Yeah. Wholeness doesn't mean perfection. It means no part left out. There's a story I like to tell of my friend John, dear friend, longtime Buddhist practitioner, by the way. And he was dying of AIDS, and a number of us were taking care of him. And it was my day to take care of him, so I went to his house in the morning, and he was sitting at the kitchen table in his bathrobe. But something was changed. And I noticed that he could no longer stand. He couldn't hold a fork. And he couldn't speak in an intelligent way. It all went overnight. All overnight. And I just kept looking across the table trying to find my friend John. I couldn't find him. He'd just been there the night before, you know. And we went through the day and took care of him, and it was hard to take care of him. It was a lot of work, you know. And I got scared. And I'm not proud of it, but I treated him like a child sometimes. And I was cajoling and manipulative and paternalistic. And the afternoon and evening rolled by, and it turned into the early hours in the morning, and I was tired. And I just wanted him to go to bed and somehow have this nightmare be over in the morning, you know. John had these anal tumors and constant diarrhea. And it was a lot of work to take care of him. I'd move him to the bath and to the toilet and back to the toilet and change his diapers. And it was a lot of work, you know. And I took him out of the bath and I put him on the toilet, and I was turning to the sink, you know, the vanity sink, and I was washing my hands, you know, and I looked in the mirror and he was mouthing to me. He was whispering to me, "You're trying too hard." And I was trying way too hard to be somebody, to be someone special. Me, Mr. Hospice, yeah? Mr. Zen Hospice. And I sat down beside the toilet and I just wept. And it was the most sweet and tender and most intimate moment of our whole friendship. There beside the toilet, you know, shit everywhere. You see, I'd been afraid to go there before that. I was afraid that if I went into that territory of helplessness where John was, I might get lost. But that's not what happened. You know, I went into that place with him, and there we discovered what really needed to happen. You know? But I couldn't have known that from the outside. You know? You know, in Buddhist practice, our teachings about compassion rest in the wisdom of non-separation, that we're tangled up together. Yeah. There's so many treaties on compassion and endless talks and writings. But I tend to boil it down to two dimensions of compassion, we could say. The first is really what we might call universal or boundless compassion. That everything and everyone has always been embraced by this compassion, whether you knew it or not. Yeah. Everything. And then there's everyday compassion, when we do stuff. You know, when we change soiled sheets, or we feed someone, or we stand up against injustice. That's another kind of compassion, another level of compassion, we could say. Now, everyday compassion gets exhausting. We get tired, you know, from our good works. And we want people to thank us and appreciate all the good things we're doing for the world, you know. So everyday compassion has to be sourced in absolute compassion, in boundless compassion, in universal compassion. It has to be sourced there. We have to understand it just doesn't come from us. It's not a skill set we learn. But boundless compassion, universal compassion, is just a big idea unless it manifests through us. So for boundless compassion to take shape in the world, it has to come through our eyes and tongues, through our arms and legs. That's how it manifests in the world. And it does that out of an understanding that we're not separate. Do you know this beautiful image in Tibetan tradition of Avalokiteshvara? You know, she has 1,000 arms. Yeah, 1,000 arms. And depending on the depiction, she has either an eye in each hand to see the suffering of the world, or an ear to hear the cries of the world. Yeah, and 1,000 arms to respond. It's just a beautiful image, beautiful metaphor. You've probably seen her in Cost Plus or someplace, yeah? Yeah. Yeah. Just a beautiful image. I have a friend, Bernie Glassman, a wonderful Zen teacher, and I really admire him. He's been a mentor to me. Great man. And he was talking about this Avalokiteshvara in Germany some years ago, and he was teaching about the metaphor, and a man stood up and said, "It's a beautiful image, but I only have 2 arms. What should I do?" And Bernie, in a very kind way, said to him, "I'm sorry, but you're mistaken." And the man looked. He said, "No, quite sure. I only have 2 arms." And then Bernie did something really simple. He had everybody in the room raise both their arms. "Go ahead, do it. Look around. Look around. Check it out. This is Avalokiteshvara. You are. You are Avalokiteshvara." We are the 1,000 arms. The 4th invitation is find a place of rest in the middle of things. Most of us think we're too busy, and we probably are. There's a beautiful old Zen story, you know, about one monk sweeping the temple grounds. Yeah, you've maybe heard this before. And another monk very snidely comes up and says, "Too busy," like that. We always imagine spiritual communities are loving, kind places. Not always. Not always. So this kind of snide monk says, "Too busy." But the sweeping monk, he says, "Oh, you should know, there is one who is not too busy." And really what he's talking about was that although his external activity was active, engaged, inside he was quite still. Find a place of rest in the middle of things. You know, most of us imagine we'll find rest later, like when we go on retreat or we have a vacation or when our list gets checked off. I don't know about you, but my list never gets checked off. And if I wait for that, I'm in trouble. So I have to learn to find a way of resting right in the middle of whatever it is I'm doing, like now. And we do that by bringing our attention fully and completely to whatever it is we're engaged in. That's how we find rest. There was a woman I worked with. She was this rough, tough Russian Jewish lady, 86 years old. Real character, you know. I love the characters. Anyway, we knew each other for some time. She was with us for a few months. And the night she was dying, they called me up. And so I always went in whenever there was someone dying. I tried my best to go in and be with them. And so I came in the room, and she was sitting on the edge of the bed, her feet sort of dangling off the edge of the bed in her dressing gown. And I went in, and I sit in the corner. That's my way. I go in, sit down, and see, is anything really needed before we jump in to help, you know? And sitting there in the corner, I just watched. And I saw that Adele was breathing with great difficulty. You know, every in-breath struggle, every out-breath struggle. And this despite the interventions that were appropriate, you know, oxygen and morphine and the other interventions. There's a labor to dying, just like there's a labor to getting born. And there was a very wonderful home health aide, an attendant, sitting next to her on the bed, and very kindly she said, Adele, she said, honey, you don't have to be scared. We're right here with you. And Adele, who was this tough cookie, she turned to her and she said, honey, if this was happening to you, you'd be scared. Like that. So I stayed in the corner. Yeah. A little while later, this very well-meaning attendant, she turned to Adele and she said, oh, honey, you look a little cold. Would you like a blanket or a shawl on your shoulders? And Adele shot back, of course, I'm cold. I'm almost dead. I mean, I hope I have half the tenacity of this woman when I'm dying, you know? So I saw two things there. Maybe you saw them in the story. One was what I described a moment ago about that there is struggle, and the struggle in her case was manifest in the breath. And the second thing was that she didn't want any nonsense. She didn't want to talk about tunnels of light or bardos or any of these things, you know? She just wanted real relationship, an authentic meeting. So I pulled my chair up really close to her. We knew each other for some while, so I could be quite honest with her. And I looked her in the eye and I said, Adele, would you like to struggle a little less? And she said, yes. I said, okay. I said, I noticed something. I said, I noticed just there at the end of your exhale, before the next inhale, there was this little gap, this little pause, you know? I wonder if you could just put your attention there for a minute. See what happens. Now, 86-year-old Russian Jewish lady, she doesn't care beans about Buddhism or meditation or any of these things. But she's highly motivated in this moment to be free of suffering. And that's what gets most of us on the meditation cushion, isn't it? Yeah. So I said, I'll do it with you. You know, I'll breathe with you. I didn't guide her. I didn't do any special thing. I just, if she would breathe in, I would breathe in. If she would breathe out, I would breathe out. Just accompanied her. And you know, gradually she let her attention come to that gap, that pause, you know, that place that's a moment of either fear or faith. You know how that is when you're breathing? And either you let that gap be there, or you start manipulating your breath in some way, reaching for the next inhale. And she did that too. But then there was this point at which she started to relax. You remember I said when I gave the meditation instruction tonight, that for me meditation instruction, the right effort in meditation instruction is a balance not between energy and striving, but between relaxation and interest. Yeah. And Adele found that. And you could see the fear in her face just drain away. And then she said, I think I'm going to rest now. And she laid back down on her bed, and a short while later she died very peacefully. I think Adele found the place of rest in the middle of things. Do you understand? All the situation was still the same. All the conditions were still the same. She was still dying. There was erratic breathing. All of that stuff was there. We're always trying to manage the conditions to try and, you know, get the right situation. But these conditions were unmanageable. And so she found herself resting right in the middle of them. She found it in the gap at the end of the exhale, before the next inhale. Where do you find it? Yeah. You know, there's this common phenomenon that happens oftentimes with people diagnosed with cancer. They don't speak about it to their doctors or even sometimes their therapists, but they speak about it to each other. And they talk about it as a secret gratitude. And what it means is that I can say no now. I don't have to be with that person or that work or that activity. I got cancer. I don't have to do that now. I can say no. I always felt obliged to say yes. But now I can just rest. Do we have to die before we can rest in peace? We're always talking in our practice about mindfulness and how we use the body and the breath to stabilize and to calm ourselves. What will you pay attention to when you can't find your breath? You know, in this heart attack I had, you know, I was long surgery, big deal, you know, they split you open like a crab, you know, pull you back. And they even lift your heart slightly out of your body. So for a little while I was completely heartless, really. And after the surgery, which is a big long surgery, takes 12 hours or so, I don't know, I was in the recovery unit, which was felt a bit like a Star Trek episode. You know, there's monitors beeping and I had hoses and tubes going in and out of every orifice, you know, morphine coming into one arm, clot blockers going into another, you know. And I was intubated still. I had a machine breathing for me. Yeah. And my son was there, my adult son, and my best friend Eugene was there, meditation teacher. And into the room came a guy who said, "Let's pull out that tube and see if you can breathe." Yeah. So I could feel something wasn't quite right, and I waved my arms, no. And my friend Eugene, he said, "Frank, find your breath." And I tried to find my breath, but I couldn't find my breath. I couldn't distinguish what was my breath and what was the machine breathing for me. So I shook my head, no. And then he said, "Well, then sense your body, Frank, sense your body." And I tried to sense my body, but it was kind of in an anesthesia fog. And I couldn't really get much attention to my body. Yeah. So I wrote on a piece of paper, "I'm scared." And at that moment I remembered Suzuki Roshi. Your teachers come to you in just the right moment sometimes. Suzuki Roshi was a teacher of mine who I never met. And you know, before he was dying, the night before he was dying, in fact, Suzuki Roshi, he wanted to take a bath, to get clean. It's funny, my father wanted to do the same thing. And Oka-san, his wife, said, "No, no, 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 too much." But he insisted, and so his son, Otohiro, picked him up and carried him into the bathroom and lowered him into warm water. And as he lowered Suzuki Roshi into warm water, Suzuki Roshi became terrified. He was afraid he would drown. You know, he couldn't swim, Suzuki Roshi. It's a great story about that for some other time, but... And his son, Otohiro, said, "Father, calm yourself. Find your breath. I'll breathe with you." And Suzuki Roshi was able to stabilize and be fine, you know. And in this moment in the recovery unit, I remembered this. And I thought, well, if Suzuki Roshi can be scared, I can be scared, you know. But then I pulled my friend Eugene close to me and I put my ear next to his mouth. And I just borrowed the rhythm of his breath until I could find my own, you know. I just stabilized on his breathing until I could find my own. Find a place of rest in the middle of things. The fifth and last invitation is cultivate don't know mind. And I felt obliged to put something Zen-like in this list. I created the Zen Hospice, you know, so. And Zen is full of these kinds of expressions, you know, that nobody really understands. They're meant to push you out of your logical mind, your conceptual mind, and come into direct experience. I remember giving Suzuki Roshi's book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, to my son when he was a teenager. And he started to read it. He said, "Dad, what the hell is he talking about? I don't know, you know." To cultivate don't know mind, this is not an encouragement to be ignorant. Yeah, ignorance is not knowing. Ignorance is that we know something and it's the wrong thing and we insist on it. There's a lot of that happening in the world right now. Yeah. Don't know mind represents something else entirely. It goes beyond knowing and not knowing altogether. Don't know mind is characterized by curiosity, by interest, by surprise, by wonder. Yeah. You know, an open mind is characterized by spaciousness infused with interest. Yeah. When our minds are made up, you know, narrows our vision. And it impedes our ability to act, actually. So don't know mind is an invitation to enter with fresh eyes, to empty our minds and open our hearts. I remember when the night before my surgery, my son Gabe, he came to see me, and you know, we were shooting the breeze. He brought a video. He thought it would be good to watch a video the night before my surgery. He brought the bucket list. We got about 15 minutes into it, and I said, "You know, maybe this isn't the best movie." I love my son so much. And, you know, we were having a conversation, just a shooting the breeze conversation. And in the middle of it, he just said, "Dad, are you going to live through this?" And "Father, I want to reassure my son." So I began to say, "Don't worry, it'll be fine, you know." But out of my mouth, I heard myself say, "I'm not taking sides." And it totally shocked me. It really surprised me. And it surprised him too. And I wasn't trying to be Buddhist or sage or any of those things. It was just the truth of that moment coming out. And you know, when the truth's in the room, we all relax a little bit more. You know, spiritual traditions, they talk of realization and awakening and enlightenment and all these words which feel a little far off to me, honestly. That somehow we'll be transported to some other dimension, you know, beyond day-to-day problems. And I prefer the word intimacy. I don't hardly ever use the word mindfulness practice anymore. People ask me, "What's your practice?" I say, "Intimacy. Learning to be intimate with myself and the world." It's relaxed and receptive and ordinary. The intimacy of don't know mind, it encourages us to connect with everything, with the sound of the birds and nature and the spring breeze and this very life, you know, and the truth that's here, right here and now. To know the sacred, it isn't about seeing new things. It's about seeing things in a new way. And the sacred is not something separate or different than everything else in life. It's hidden in everything else in life. It's hidden in all things. And the dying process is a process of uncovering. That's what it is, you know. All the ways I've defined myself, you know, I'm a Buddhist teacher, I'm a father, I'm this, I'm that, you know. All of those definitions, all of those identities are either stripped away by illness or gracefully given up, but they all go. And then who are you? At Zen Hospice, we had a unit at a big hospital, Laguna Honda Hospital. Laguna Honda Hospital is a hospital that was built before the turn of the last century, in the late 1800s. And it, in the old hospital, when we first began there, we were given the basement and back of the hospital to start a hospice unit in. I remember the head of nursing said to me, "Nobody dies in my hospital." This was a geriatric hospital, 1,100 beds. 1% of the people in this hospital had insurance. So if you're poor and alone, this is where you go. And you have to imagine these big wards with 30 or 40 people in one room, bed after bed after bed. There's nothing like it this side of Calcutta, you know. And it's a beautiful place. Everybody dying, living and dying together. You know, that was what one of the things that was extraordinary. You know, when we first went there, I thought, no, this is our worst nightmare, you know. We should shut this place down. And then I thought, no, if we can create a hospice in this place, if we can show that compassionate care is possible in this place, then we can demonstrate that it's possible anywhere. And people would see others dying around them, you know, and they would see that they weren't in pain and that they weren't left alone and that they were okay. So one day I'm walking down through this gauntlet of beds and there's an older African-American man there, and big man, big guy. And I noticed that he was breathing with great difficulty and he was sweating. And so I just stopped, you know, intuitively, you know, and I went over and I sat down beside him and he was puffing and really working hard. And I said, "You know, you look like you're working really hard." And he was kind of in and out of consciousness, but he'd say, "Yeah, I just got to get there." And he pointed like that. And I said, "Oh," I said, "if I promise to keep up, can I go?" And he said, "Yeah," and he grabbed my hand. Yeah. And I said, "I didn't bring my glasses. I can't see there into the distance. Can you see?" And he described a sloping hillside to a kind of plateau. And I said, "You want to go?" "Yeah." So up we walked up this hill to this plateau, and it was hard work getting up that hill. He was puffing and puffing, yeah, sweating up a storm. And I said, "Can you see there further into the distance? I can't make it out." And he said, "Yeah," and he described for me a little one-room red schoolhouse with three steps and a door. This is a man born in Mississippi. He probably went to such a school. Now, I could have said to him, "You're disoriented times three. This is a result of the morphine and the brain metastasis. Let me help orient you to space and time," which is the interventions we would make in most medical settings. But that wasn't really what was true. What was true is we were going to a little red schoolhouse. I said, "There's the door. There's the stairs. There's the door. You want to go in?" "Yeah." I said, "Can I go?" I always ask permission. He said, "No." And I said, "Okay, then you go." And sometime later, he died very peacefully. Yeah. You know, in dying, we come to understand that we can't really hold on to our treasured possessions, whether that's our things or our ideas or our beliefs even. You know, there was a guy I worked with, Brian, I remember he gave away his Les Paul guitar, which was his most treasured possession, you know. And I said, "Wow, that was a big deal to do that." And he said, "Yeah, there are no storage rooms in heaven." You know, letting go is how we prepare for dying, if we can prepare for it at all. Suzuki Roshi used to teach that renunciation is not about giving up the things of the world, but accepting that they go away. You know, letting go reveals the flip side of loss. You know, when we let go of old grudges, we give ourselves to peace. When we let go of fixed views, we give ourselves to not knowing. When we let go of self-sufficiency, we give ourselves into the care of others. When we let go of clinging, we give ourselves to gratitude. When we let go of control, we give ourselves to surrender. Now, surrender is infinitely deeper than letting go. When we let go, we have this feeling of distancing ourselves from something, like setting something down, right? And there's a freedom in it, beautiful freedom in it. But there's this feeling of a bit of distance. I've set it down now. Yeah? Surrender is different. The experience of surrender is more like coming closer, actually. And it feels like expansiveness. And you're free, there's a freedom in it, but it's not from setting something down. You're free because who you've expanded this in such a way that who you are now is not limited by your previous ideas. The surrender feels something more like coming close. I say the surrender is the getting in the flow, you know? My dad used to like to swim in the ocean when we were kids. We lived on the East Coast. We'd go to Jones Beach, I remember. And, you know, he'd go out into the waves, and I just loved watching. I was a little scared, actually, but I kind of loved watching him do it. And I would just see his big white belly like float up over the waves, you know? You can't float if you're holding on too tightly, you know? I say that surrender is the end of two and the beginning of one. You know, our Buddhist practice that we have here, we reflect on death a lot, you know? At least we're supposed to. But it's not an ideology, it's not a belief system that protects us from our dying. Or promises us some other experience after we die. You know, it's not a morbid activity, it's life-affirming, actually. And it helps us to really, you know, the value of these reflections is not so much about some protection, it's that it shows us how our relationship to death is affecting us here and now. That's its beauty. And the contemplation on death and the inherent mystery that's involved in it, it's too important to be left to the final moments of our life. It's too important. Rumi wrote, "The door is round and open. Don't go back to sleep." I was sitting at Zen Hospice one day, at the kitchen table, reading a book of Japanese death poems. And you know this tradition, Japanese death poems, you know, you on the day of your death, you write a poem that tells the essential truth of your life. And if you don't die that day, it doesn't count. You have to write a new one the next day. Yeah. So, and it's an old tradition, you know, beautiful, you know, you've seen probably or heard many of these great old poems, you know, like the one from Kozan, empty-handed, I entered the world, barefoot, I leave it. My coming and going, two simple happenings that got entangled. So I was sitting at the kitchen table reading this book of death poems, hanging out, and one of the patients in the house, this woman Sono, she was sitting there opposite me, and she said, "What is that?" And I explained the tradition. She said, "I want to write one of those." And I said, "Good idea, you should do that." Sono was a woman who lived, you know, everyday life. Nice woman, older now, existing on her SSI check, you know, living on the margins of society, you know. Some friends, granddaughter. Anyway, she went upstairs and she wrote her poem, and a few hours later she summoned me to her room. And she said, "Frank, I've written my death poem, and when I die I want it to be pinned to my clothes and I want to be cremated with it." And I said, "Oh, son, I promise I will do that, thank you. I promise you we'll do that." And then she said, "But I want you to learn it first. Now." And she said, "I want you to learn it by heart." She didn't say memorize it. Words are important. She said, "I want you to learn it by heart." She said, "I want to know that it lives in your soul." Want to hear a poem? You know, I've never written this poem down. This happened 25, 28 years ago. I don't know how long time ago. I never wrote it down, and people asked me for it many, many times, and I never gave it to them. And I just felt like it was just this oral tradition, you know, that I could say it, but I couldn't write it down. I'm weird that way. But when I was writing the book, I wanted to put it in the book. So I called her granddaughter, who I hadn't talked to in 20 years, you know. And I said, you know, this is Sona's poem, you might remember. Oh, I remember it really well, and I remember you. And I said, you know, I'd like to put the poem in the book. What do you think? And she was very kind, you know. She said, yeah, I definitely think we should do it, you know. Okay, here's her poem. She says, "Don't just stand there with your hair turning gray. Soon enough the seas will sink your little island. So while there is still the illusion of time, set out for some other shore. No sense packing a bag. You won't be able to lift it into your boat. So give away all of your collections. Take only new seeds and an old stick. Send out some prayers on the wind before you sail. Don't be afraid. Someone knows you're coming. An extra fish has been salted." "Don't just stand there with your hair turning gray. Soon enough the seas will sink your little island. So while there is still the illusion of time," that's a great line, "set out for some other shore." In other words, practice now. No sense packing a bag. You won't be able to lift it in your boat. I don't know anyone I've ever worked with who said, "I wished I'd gotten the second Mercedes," you know. "Give away all of your collections. Take only new seeds and an old stick." That's a beautiful line. You know farmers, how you put a stick in the ground, drop a seed in that hole, put another stick, make another hole, drop a seed in. This is her telling us it's not a full stop. This is her experience. This is not me. It's not my experience. This is her experience. "Send out some prayers on the wind before you sail." In other words, ask for some help. It's too hard to do alone. "Don't be afraid. Someone knows you're coming. An extra fish has been salted." So these are the five invitations. They have been my guides in working with people who are dying, being with dying for 30 years now, I guess, close to it. But they also have a relevance for the rest of us in living a life of meaning and purpose and to live fully. Yeah. So I offer them to you, and I hope that they're of some support to you. And thank you. Thank you for your willingness to listen. Yeah. So we have a little time. We could explore a little bit, talk a little bit together. Maybe you have a question or a comment, or you thought everything I had to say was a bunch of hooey. I don't know. That's okay. But let's see what's on your hearts and minds, and we'll see what we can discover together. Okay? So, yeah, please. He's asking if there were events in my life that drew me to this work. Yeah. You know, Death and I have been longtime companions. My mom died when I was about 16 or so, my dad a few years later. So I was introduced to Death very early. Buddhist practice and its emphasis on impermanence was an important and early engagement for me. I spent a little time in refugee camps in southern Mexico where I saw a lot of horrible dying. I was around at the very beginning of the HIV epidemic when we didn't know what we were dealing with. In San Francisco alone, there were 30,000 people. 30,000 people dying of HIV. One city. One area. You know, we forget about this. You know, we forget what a... And that was one place. And I thought, I have to say, for me it was one of the most... I felt it was a one of the greatest spiritual movements of the 20th century. But, you know, if I'm really honest, those are all factors, you know. But if I'm really honest, I think really what got me is that I really wanted to get out of my own pain. And I thought if I could work with other people who were in worse pain than mine, mine might not seem so bad. But it doesn't work. You know, at some juncture you have to turn toward your own suffering, you know. And that becomes the ground of compassion, you know, by turning toward what we want to run away from. Yeah. So all those things, I think, were influences. Yeah, please.
I had my sister die last June, and was not by choice. She had cancer. I was with her for the last couple of months. And so I was interested in coming tonight and hearing just what might touch me. And I'm a high school teacher. And I have a student who's, for the last couple of weeks, has been trying to commit suicide.
Yeah.
And, you know, really different circumstances, like deciding as opposed to not having a choice. And
yeah.
I just wonder if you have any thoughts about suicide just as a thing, you know, not so much advice for me or anything.
Yeah. I'm just going to paraphrase it for the recording, but so he was saying that he's a teacher in school and that his own sister died some time ago from cancer, but now that he has a student who's expressing suicidal thoughts anyway. And what do we do with this? What can we understand about this? I don't have a lot of advice. I mean, I think that This is hard. This is hard as it gets. I mean, I think it has to be okay with us that someone wants to commit suicide, otherwise we can't help them. You know, if we stand back in moral judgment around it, we don't help anybody. I think we also have to, sometimes it's helpful to understand that sometimes suicide is the best option people can think of. It may not be the only option, but it may be the only one they have access to. And they're in such pain, oftentimes, or such confusion, that it's their only way. And, you know, one of the challenges of doing the work that you do as a teacher, I think, is that we're thrown into these situations where there's a great deal of moral distress, where some part of you feels like you know the right thing to do, but you can't do it, you know? And that's hard on us as well. And so it's really important that amongst your colleagues, you speak to that, you know, you speak to that moral distress. Yeah. You know, it's like working with folks who are dying. You can't do that work every day and come home and use the same coping strategies everybody else uses. A glass of wine and watching TV won't do it, you know. So when you're doing the work that you do and working with kids as close as in situations like the one you described, you got to have other coping strategies, you know. You got to get on your cushion, or you got to be with a group of people who understand. That helps. I worked with a guy. I was with a lot of people who were sick, and suicide became an option for them. There was one guy I worked with, and he wanted to commit suicide, and I said, okay. He said, will you help me? And I said, well, I'll help you. I won't help you commit suicide, but I'll be with you. And I said, but first you got to turn the TV off. You know, I mean, that's kind of where we were. And we went out and got 7 stones. This is something that I learned from one of my teachers. We had 7 stones and put them in a bowl next to his bed. And I said, okay, here's the deal. I'll work with you, but you gotta, every day you have to take out one stone, you have to hold that stone all day. And during the course of the day, you have to reflect on what has been useful in your life, what you're grateful for, what others have done for you. You know, it's okay. So that if you go to this, you go to this consciously. I wasn't trying to stop him. But what happened was by the fifth day of reflecting on all this, he chose to stop. So it's got to be okay with you. Moral judgment doesn't help. Moral distress is your work to do. And, you know, as much as you can, find out what hurts. And tell him he's loved. Don't just tell him he's loved, show him he's loved. You know, I mean, we've just been dealing with the most horrific, another horrific school shooting, right? Wow. I was teaching a retreat recently, and one of my students said, I can't read the newspapers anymore. It's just too hard. And I said, well, reading the newspaper is compassion practice. And I said, you know, I read about school shootings. I actually read all of them. I don't read every thing about them, but I read about them. And some of them don't always get reported correctly. A lot of them don't. There was a beautiful story that happened here in Oregon, just south of us. A kid came to school with a handgun, shot three times, wounded one kid in the leg, hit another girl, another bullet ricocheted off a wall. And there was this teacher, Janice Regan, I think her last name was. She was a gym teacher. And she walked right up to the kid, not in confrontation. Somehow, I don't know where she got this courage, but somehow, in the connection with him, she persuaded him to give her the gun. And then she did the most remarkable thing. She hugged him. And then she promised to go with him everywhere he went, through the booking process, through his court trials. She went with him everywhere. Wow. There was another guy in Bakersfield I read about, a biology teacher. Kid came to school with a shotgun and lots of bullets, and showed up at the door of his biology class, and his teacher stood in the door. Again, not confrontationally, and not everybody can do this, and I'm not suggesting this is a strategy to use, but this is what happened. And this, somehow, in this exchange, kid gave the teacher the shotgun. And I was reading the article about it, and there was an interview with the teacher's father. And the interviewer was saying, well, how did your son learn to do this, and how did it work? And the father said, oh, he said, I don't know. He said, the boy knew my son, and my son knew the boy. That was all. The boy knew my son, and my son knew the boy. I thought, wow. We got to get to know each other and what hurts in each other. There's no solutions and easy fixes for this stuff. But thanks for trying. Break your heart wide open, this work. Anybody else?